You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
For Dear Science this week, we are joined once again by expert Dr. Krishna McGovern. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
We're having a lovely, it's a little bit cloudy, but it's a nice day here, especially now that classes are done.
Yeah, it's pretty quiet around there at the moment,
and
the recreation centre is almost done, so the construction noises.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on, I'll just adjust. Should be good now. So we've got lots of science today, and we've got a bit about bugs, right? Which I noticed when looking at these stories.
Yeah, I hadn't actually picked up on that. I was like, oh, it's very biological, and then when you're like, oh, it's kind of buggy, and I'm like, oh, yeah, it is.
All right, so we'll start off with these monarch butterflies. Where are they going, and what are we doing about it?
So monarch butterflies, actually, there's this amazing migration they have, and this is definitely on my bucket list of life to one day get to Mexico and see this. Basically, each year the eastern monarch butterfly will migrate from where it spends its summer over in breeding in the US and Canada, and then they'll fly to Mexico to hibernate over winter. And this is a trip of about 4,500 kilometres.
Right.
So a big trip.
Yep.
And what's really also amazing is that it's not like there are multiple generations of the butterflies occurring during this migration because it takes so long.
Oh, wow.
And that butterflies don't have long lives.
Mm.
So one thing I read said, for the spring migration back to the US and Canada, it can be, three generations.
And they all just know to keep going.
Yeah. I didn't really look into that, so I don't know quite how that works.
Wow.
So it's this really highly evolved migratory pattern, but there's been a steady decline in numbers since the 1990s, and this is due to things like the grasslands where they will stop over and... in the US and Canada have been converted to farmlands. People are using herbicides and pesticides. There's been deforestation in Mexico where they winter, and then there's the reduction of milkweed, which is the only plant that they actually lay eggs on.
Ah, all right.
And then, of course, we've got climate change as well, you know. and so the science story we're talking about today actually just focuses on the Mexico end of the migration. And so in Mexico, what they did, I'm not sure when, but it was a really clever idea, is that they've made the Monarch Butterfly Biosphere Reserve. And this is in Central Mexico. And so this is where I really want to go one day. So if you've got time, check it out on YouTube. You can see, there's just thousands and thousands of monarch butterflies come to this area, and they rest in these Oyamel fir trees. And this is where they winter.
A bit of a hotel for monarch butterflies.
Exactly, yeah, right? And if you watch some of the videos, there's so many. It's just orange and black everywhere. But you can actually hear the
that's incredible. Wow.
It's just incredible. We've got, obviously a bunch of scientists and conservationists really concerned about the habitat. Because this actually is really good for the local economy, but it's also because we want to keep the monarch butterfly nice and strong population. And so what's been happening is their habitat is actually moving up the mountain, basically. It's increasingly going to higher altitudes just with climate.
As the climate warms,
they need a cooler temperature, so they're going higher. And so because they overwinter in these fir trees, these fir trees actually have a natural maximum altitude that they grow to. It's kind of like a ceiling. So what these scientists have done is they've gone, okay, well, will these trees grow higher up the mountain? They don't necessarily like it, but if we plant them, will they grow?
Mm.
And so several years ago, on the main mountain where these monarch butterflies overwinter, they planted some, they were about 400 above the natural maximum.
Yep.
And they grew. So
that's
now...
good.
They're looking at this mountain, they're going, well, we actually run out of mountain. The mountain's not high enough. So let's see if there's one close by, which they found, which I've forgotten the name, sorry. And it's about 1,000 metres taller. And so what they've done is they've gone and they've planted on this mountain, and they've basically, at four different elevations, to see how the trees will grow. So naturally, these trees will grow up to about 3,500 metres above sea level.
Yep.
And so they've planted above this, and they basically, they were giving these saplings, baby trees, the best chance they could. So they would plant them in circles around a shrub so they had shade and protection so that they could get a hold of it, basically, and start growing.
Yep.
Let them go for 3 years or three growing cycles, and then came back and had a look. And so 68% of them survived at 3,800 metres, so that's 300 metres above what they normally would be, and 44% at 4,000 metres above sea level. So they grew, they survived. They did grow a bit more slowly, but why this is encouraging to these scientists and these conservationists is that maybe there'll still be a habitat for the monarch butterflies to come back to, which is what we need, right?
Because that's quite worrying. And you said it's in Mexico, right?
Yes.
So I assume it'd be pretty warm most of the year round.
I guess it's there's probably a lot of different climates within Mexico.
And you'd be facing the effects of climate change quite strongly.
Yeah, exactly.
I imagine,
and,
yeah.
And they estimate that there was one number they saw that there's, for potential future landing spots for these monarch butterflies, they think they might need to establish about 5,000 trees that are mature by 2060s to actually maintain a good population. So there's a lot of excitement and also, you know, trepidation and making sure they
sounds a bit urgent there.
Yeah.
And then furthermore, some more bugs, worms and snails. What are these guys doing?
Okay, so this is all we're going. So we're looking at 4,000 above meters above sea level. Now we're going 2,500 meters below sea level. And so what we have just off the coast of Central America is something called the East Pacific Rise. And it's basically where two tectonic plates are moving away from each other.
Mm.
And so when this happens, it opens up hydrothermal vents that let out water that's been heated by the magma in the earth, and this water is loaded with chemical compounds. And so you might have seen the mention of these hydrothermal vents in relation to deep sea mining, because you get lots of really valuable minerals and stuff in there. And so this area has been explored since the 1970s. So you think they must have found everything by now, but they've actually just made a recent discovery of a lot of worms and snails.
Mm.
And so what they had a remote-controlled submarine that actually had a little digger on it so they could lift up some rocks, right?
That sounds really cool.
And then, they had its camera as well. And so what they've gone down is they've gone down to this area and they've lifted up some rocks. And what they actually found were some cavities under some of these rocks. And in these cavities, they basically describe it as an underwater zoo. There were worms, limpets, in their shells, and sea snails. And you know, this hadn't been observed before, because who looks into the earth's crust to find animals, right? Like
don't think about them being there.
No, and it's a bit like, you know, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about the 2-billion-year-old rocks that got bacteria in it, right? It's kind of this, you know, we're starting to see this more and more, where we think we know the earth, we think we know the planet, and clearly we have a lot to learn.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem very intuitive that there'd be a full ecosystem down there, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? Because what they did say was, you know, the temperature is about 25 degrees in these areas, because you've obviously got this warm water meeting this cold water. There is oxygen. There is, they called it, a moderate concentration of toxic hydrogen sulfide, because they are these hydrothermal vents. And so those, in terms of those conditions, it's kind of, they could live. But it's 2,500 metres under the surf, like below sea level. So you think of the pressure we have here, it's 250 times that down there. So there's a lot of pressure.
Oh, wow, yeah.
I did try and find an analogy for what that would feel like. And so the American Natural History Museum kind of described it as, think of your big toe being stood on by an elephant.
Got it.
Yep.
Not so great.
Not so great, right? Yeah. A lot of pressure. The other thing is that they think that, the animals probably don't go too much deeper, because the temperature does increase quite quickly, the oxygen content in the water decreases quickly, and you get a lot more hydrogen sulfide. It's completely dark down there, right? And so what are these things living off? And they actually live off nutrients that are produced by the bacteria in the area. So, you know, people are quite familiar with seeing lots of bacteria in that, but you know, like when you see animals in the deep ocean or deep sea, they're always a bit funky as well, because they've got to handle these pressures and stuff. And one thing that they were really interested in is they've noticed that when these new hydrothermal vents open up, there's you do see worms and sea snails quite quickly, and they're like, what's going on? And they think it's basically the larvae are carried on cold water, get mixed into the warm water, and they settle out and they grow. And the one kind of take home from the study that I was thought was really interesting was, you know, we do see stuff about these hydrothermal vents in terms of deep sea mining a lot. And they're like, there is actually a faunal system. There is an ecosystem. We need to
to be protecting those as well. Yeah, really interesting. And then lastly here, Tasmanian tigers.
Yes. So I debated about talking about this story a little bit, because it's not, it's an announcement from a company. It's not peer-reviewed literature.
Right.
But I got to talk about Tasmanian tigers. So
yeah, they sound really cool.
They are. So Tasmanian tigers, they're basically, they're also known as Tasmanian wolf or thylacines.
Mm.
They were a carnivorous marsupial that lived in New Guinea and Australia.
Yeah.
But they disappeared from New Guinea and mainland Australia like 36 to 3200 years ago, and they were only in Tasmania. But the last one died in the Hobart Zoo in 1936.
Oh, so fully extinct.
Yeah, fully extinct.
Wow.
There are actually recordings, like video or, you know, the old school style of recordings, and there's pictures of them and stuff. But what happened is they were basically hunted to extinction.
Mm.
It was human persecution. People thought that they were a threat to their livestock, and so there was a bounty put on them, and they were hunted.
Similar stuff we'd see with New Zealand care, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. And so we were lucky in New Zealand in some regards in that the care is a pretty spunky bird that kind of survived us and is hopefully making more of a comeback. But, yeah, the Tasmanian tiger wasn't so fortunate. Now, it gets the name Tasmanian wolf because it's kind of a wolf size, and tiger, Tasmanian tiger, because it's got stripes on its back. So it's quite a cool looking.
Yeah, right.
And so it's reasonably... You know, it is reasonably recent, its extinction. So you do get museum specimens where there is DNA so that you can sequence that genome. So first time this was reported was 2017, and they basically used a 108-year-old thylacine pouch, because remember, it's a marsupial, so it's got a little pouch, and it had been preserved in alcohol, and so they were able to do some genome sequencing. What's come out recently is there's a company that has been working with people at a university, I think it was Maryland or Massachusetts, I've forgotten, sorry, called Colossus Bioscience. And this company's really into this concept of de-extinction. So they do a lot
Jurassic
of...
Jurassic Park type stuff. Yeah,
so they do a lot of genome sequencing of mammoths and obviously thylacines, because they can get material. So they've taken a skull that was preserved. It was skinned and preserved, and again, in alcohol. It's about 110 years old. And they've taken some of that DNA that they've been able to extract, sequence it, and they're saying that they've now got the most complete genome for this that has ever been sequenced before.
Right.
And, you know, so they're excited from their de-extinction point of view. What I found kind of interesting about reading with this as well is that just what you also have to do around de-extinction, like obviously it's not just...
Yeah, what's the process after you get the genome?
Well, that's really interesting, right? So one thing comment I read was like, you know, you can't just generate living cells from the DNA, right? So what they're probably going to do is they'll genetically modify something that's quite... that's most closely related. So in this case of the Tasmanian tiger, that's something called the fat-tailed dunnet, which I'm not really sure what that is. Whereas in, you know, like with mammoths, it's like elephants, right?
Yeah.
So you kind of, and so you're going to basically genetically modify them. And so some scientists will say it's more like you're recreating some of the traits. You're not really...
It's not quite the same animal. Yeah.
Whereas I think Colossus Bioscience will then go on and say, like, they're doing stuff where they have to make advances in assisted reproductive technologies. So they've figured out how to trigger ovulation in these fat-tailed dunnets. And then they've also done some work where they've got an they say that they have an artificial uterus device so that you could grow the marsupial embryos, and then that could have carryover implications for conservation and stuff. This is, again, like, you know, so they're a company, so they're moving at the pace that a company needs to move at, and not necessarily publishing everything as it goes.
Essentially what we're saying is we might be even closer than we think.
Yeah, well, they might.
Or
you know,
they might be lying.
it's one or the other.
Yeah, so maybe we could see Jurassic Park soon, or we might see it in a movie again. They seem to keep making those.
Don't they just?
Yeah, coming out all the time. All right, well, you can listen to maybe not some Jurassic Park, but some lovely radio. We've got the National Party interview up after this break. But beforehand, obviously, thank you, Kushla, for coming in. Thank you, Mosat, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after a short break. Keep it on the B.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to Mosat, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.